Mr. Hug, good morning to you. And Mr. Lewis, good morning to you. Do either of you have any questions before you begin?
I do not.
With that then, Mr. Hug, you may approach and you may proceed.
Thank you.
Each side has 20 minutes in this case.
May it please the court, members of the court, Chief Justice. This case is on appeal from a conviction in Douglas County District Court as a result of a jury trial. I was appointed for purposes of the appeal. Mr. Lorello was convicted of first-degree murder and use
and
of a weapon.
I take it you don't have a retainer.
Pardon me?
I take it you don't have a retainer.
No. I do not. Very interesting argument. But, and we've raised three issues on appeal. One is sufficiency of the evidence resulting in convictions of this case. Whether the district court erred in admitting Exhibit 364, which was a compilation video that was manipulated and altered by the Douglas County Sheriff's Office.
Well, how was it manipulated?
It was altered or slowed down. Three of the frames were.
That was it. It was slowed down.
Yeah.
Have we ever commented on something like that in our cases?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, this was a very, and I'll start with that if you want. This was kind of a strange set of facts. What had happened is that they had obtained video footage from a Quick Trip gas station in Omaha wherein they identified the appellant, Mr. Lorello. And that was the same evening that they believed that Mr. Lorello killed Mr. Sador. After canvassing the neighborhood the day after the killing occurred, they were able to obtain video footage from various people that lived in the neighborhood. And that footage purported to show an individual walking away from the area where Mr. Sidoro's truck was found, a few blocks away from the scene of the crime, back towards the house. Now those videos from the neighborhood did not identify Mr. Lorello either through facial recognition or clothing or anything like that. So what they did is they took the neighborhood videos, slowed them down to try to show what they called walking mannerisms, similar walking mannerisms between the individual that they believed was Mr. Lorello walking through the neighborhood back to the scene of the crime and the one video where they could identify Mr. Lorello as being at the gas station that night.
Were all the videos slowed down or just some of them?
It's been a few months since I've seen the video. My recollection was that it was a four-panel video and that I believe it was two of the four were slowed down to show a similarity in the walking mannerisms, which is odd because there wasn't anything in the record that I was aware of that there was some sort of signature walk, he had a limp or anything in that way, shape, or form that I think might have been relevant, or any similarity in the clothings between what was seen at the Quick Trip and what was visible or not visible on the neighborhood.
In testimony, did the witnesses for the state acknowledge that the videos had been slowed down?
Yes, that was Ms. Penry.
And was there the videos at real-time speed, were they also offered into evidence and available to the jury?
They were.
The jury would have had the opportunity to watch them not only at a slower speed, but in real-time speed.
Well, based upon the exhibits, I don't know what technology they had to view the videos, if there were speed controls on the non-slowed-down videos, or if they were just a raw.
But the real-time videos were published to the jury during the trial.
They were admitted at trial, yes.
And hypothetically, is this something the jury, in a case, is this something a jury could do? If they had the technology, could they, while during their deliberations, say to the judge, we want to see all of these exhibits, and then during their deliberations, they might slow them down.
And I can't remember the name of the case. I think there's a similar set of facts, which the state raised in their brief, where they were able to reverse and forward video I think jurors, they're instructed that they are supposed to look at the evidence that is submitted to them in the way that it's submitted to them. But I don't know. I don't know what jurors are going to do behind the scenes. I've had cases where jurors have asked for the ability to do certain things, and the judges said, no, the evidence is the evidence.
How were the, what was the jury advised as to the significance of the, I'll call it gate evidence?
By the court or by the witnesses?
Everybody.
Okay. It was the state's position that, based upon their theory, that Mr. Lorello had met the victim at the house for purposes of leasing the house or signing a lease, shot him in the back of the head at close range, eventually left and moved the vehicle a few blocks away in the neighborhood, and then walked back to the house, back to the scene of the crime. And this was, the significance was that there was an individual caught on camera walking back towards the scene of the crime. And the significance of slowing down the neighborhood video to compare it with the quick shot or quick trip video was to show similar walking mannerisms.
Okay. I see, I've read too many crime novels because I'm under the impression that gait is not something that is readily changed. You dye your hair, grow a beard or something.
Well, and there was quite a discussion in the record. Trial counsel filed a motion in limine and was talking about gait analysis, and the state said, this isn't gait analysis. We're not going to have any expert testimony in that regard. It is, but it isn't, right? Because they said, well, Ms. Penry's not an expert. She's
but,
not
but
going
no
to
one,
give an opinion.
No one offered an opinion that based on the gait, these were the same people depicted, correct?
Not verbally, but I mean, that's the point of the exhibit, right?
Well, is it leaving that question to the jury?
Yeah. No, there was no statement, and the judge is very clear that the prosecution could not ask Ms. Penry to give an opinion as to whether or not these were the same people in the videos.
Is what, this a what? Foundational objection? Pardon me?
Go ahead.
The motion limine that was filed, I believe it's in transcript 123. Let's double check that. Yes, T123, I think it was a 6-page motion, framed it in my reading of it as more of a relevancy and then a, if relevant, unduly prejudicial under 403. I think the relevancy...
But you said it wasn't offered as signature.
Correct.
What is the exact nature of your argument? Is the problem that the video was slowed down? Is the problem that the videos were depicted, you know, four videos at once with some slowed down and some not?
Well,
all of that combined.
Sure. Our position on appeal is that slowing the video down to try to get it to match, keeping in mind that nobody ever identified Mr. Lorello in the other videos outside of Quick Trip. Slowing it down to try to make that identification, which was really the purpose of the exhibit, makes it irrelevant because they've altered it. They have taken it, something that didn't fit and tried to make it fit. And if it is relevant, which I'm not sure because I don't know what fact it's going to make more or less probable, a fact of consequence under the rule, was it more prejudicial, unduly prejudicial, to the extent that without saying it, they said it's the same guy?
Would the state, had the videos not been slowed down, and you just presented the speedy video and the slower video from the other location, both were presented, and the state argued, you can compare these. This one's going to look faster, this one's going to look slower, but you can determine whether or not they're similar. Would that have been totally legitimate?
I think it would have been, because they're basing it on what the cameras actually captured. And the review by the jury would be disparate pieces of evidence, and they could just discount those neighborhood cameras unless they saw something. Oh, he's got the same hat on, or...
Is there anything in the record that suggests that anything about what you, I think, have characterized as the altered video, that any of the pixels or depictions were different or inaccurately portrayed what was captured by the camera? Or are we simply talking about how fast it's played? And to take it back to the old analog world of a Super 8 camera with film, you know, frame at a time, you wouldn't be arguing, would you, that the state would not have the opportunity in that analysis to slow down the playback speed for purposes of demonstration, because it's still showing exactly what's on each frame. It would just slow down the apparent relative movement. Is there something different about the digital world in this case from that analog example I've just described and used a lot of your time to do? I'm sorry.
No, that's no problem, Justice Castle. Let me answer the first question. No, there's no allegation or evidence that the imagery itself was manipulated. Things were taken out or added or anything like that.
There was this is not a deep fake or anything.
We're correct. Yeah, no chatbots or
chatting. They're trying to make the pace the same.
Pardon me?
Trying to make the pace the same.
Yes, yes. And I think when I think about how evidence comes in, and I've been trying cases for 27 years, oftentimes there's an expert to explain why things are slowed down. There's an actual legal reason. You think about civil cases, cause of car crash, impact causing injury, things like that. This is a bit unusual to me. It doesn't surprise me, but it's unusual because without having an expert to say, we find this to be an effective way to identify someone, they're identifying someone by slowing his cadence down to match something in a known video. I would imagine, had there been notice of expert testimony in the matter, a defense attorney would have wanted to have a Fry hearing on it. But there, according, at least my reading of the record, it was
you mean
not
Daubert,
clear.
Daubert hearing.
Or Daubert, excuse me. Daubert hearing on the matter. It was not clear when this evidence was made known to the defense. I know that the judge questioned one of the defense counsels as to why it was occurring the morning of the fifth day of trial, his objection to it, but there wasn't a real solid response as to when he received, or the defense team received, if I recall, notice that Ms. Penry was going to testify with this exhibit and the way it was presented to the jury. Excuse me. So I think the way that it was given to the jury, it essentially did an end run around some sort of scientific basis to say that you can identify Mr. Lorello in the neighborhood videos based upon how he's walking in the Quick Trip video. And I think that in and of itself was unduly prejudicial to him because it places him at the scene of the crime. Assuming the jury believed that issue, places him at the scene of the crime afterwards in a location.
It places him walking around the block.
Yeah, from an area very close to where the truck was found.
But doesn't the fingerprint also inside the vehicle place him in the vehicle? Isn't there a fingerprint?
Well, there is a fingerprint on the inside door handle. But the state's theory is that that truck was parked in front of the house. It's unknown how Mr. Lorello came into contact with Mr. Sidoro at the time. He could have walked up to the door. There's nothing in the record in that regard. He could have placed his hand on the door, however that happened.
It's on the inside or the outside?
Inside. But the theory is that Mr. Lorello drove that truck from the scene of the crime. I can't remember the address, but it seemed to be three or four blocks away, and parked it in the same neighborhood. What they didn't find was anything else in the truck belonging to Mr. Lorello, Mr. Sidoro's truck. So there was no DNA on the gear shifter, on the steering wheel. It was anything like that that you would expect somebody driving a vehicle to leave behind. There was no testimony about whether Mr. Lorello had left any other information in that vehicle outside of just a fingerprint on the inside door handle. So I think in looking at the prejudice, it might be a different story if his DNA was all over the inside of that truck. But I think a mere fingerprint on the door handle lessens that harmless error kind of concern. I think that both sides have briefed the issue on sufficiency of evidence. You know what the standard is, that in viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the prosecution, the question is whether or not any rational trier of fact, which was a jury in this case, could have found the elements of the offense beyond a reasonable doubt. I've set forth in the brief what I think the grounds are that are lacking, given the state's theory that Mr. Sidoro was shot at close range, the lack of DNA found on the gun, the lack of other evidence tying Mr. Lorello to the actual crime of the homicide. And I do want to address briefly the ineffective assistance of counsel claim that's raised as the third claim, which when we're appointed on appeal is kind of hard to do. And I think this type of claim is a little bit different than a standard claim where the appellant may say, well, I told my lawyer to do X, Y, and Z, and he didn't do X, Y, and Z. It was a witness that would say this, or it was a piece of evidence or a document that I had that would have helped my case, and the lawyer, he or she ignored me, and here's what that document would have said, or what that witness would have said. Here, Mr. Lorello is making claims that he witnessed on two occasions, contact between a juror and a member of the victim's family during the course of the trial, and contact between a juror, members of the victim's family, and someone from the prosecutor's office during the course of the trial.
Is the record sufficient for us to reach this?
I don't think it is, because Mr. Lorello is not privy to what was said, which I think makes it a little different than a case where he can claim specifically how he'd be prejudiced. But this is going to take investigation, depositions, talking to the lawyers. Were you informed of this fact? Why didn't you investigate it? Why didn't you ask for a hearing with the court? And things of that nature. So I think it's raised, and hopefully raised in a way that if Mr. Lorello is not successful on appeal,
the state, I think, suggests that maybe there isn't enough detail here.
They do, yeah. How
do you respond to that?
Well, and I think that was my poorly made point, that this is a little bit different flavor of a claim. In doing post-convictions, when a client says, hey, I told my lawyer that Jane Smith would come in and testify and say that I was with her during the time of the crime, and my lawyer didn't call them, I can put that in an appeal brief or a post-conviction motion if we have a hearing on this, or this is what would have happened. I don't have the opportunity on this type of claim just because Mr. Lorello was not privy to these conversations that he saw occurring. So I don't have that kind of content where I can present it to the court to say, had the lawyer been reasonable and actually investigated these claims, this is what
skeptics would say. Skeptics might say that this is just nonsense made of whole cloth. And why should the system have to have extensive hearings and details and investigations in response to something?
And I think that is a...
That may never make any difference.
Right, and that's the issue. May never. We don't know. Why not pursue it? We're after justice. We're not after what's easy. So at least in my experience on these post-conviction claims, at least in Douglas County, making that threshold step is difficult enough. But putting lawyers through the process of trying to garner evidence that would support the determination by the court that something was in fact done that shouldn't have been done is infrequent. But it's necessary when there are facts there, because we want everyone that participates in the jury system, the criminal system, to feel like they were treated fairly. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lewis, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska. This is Mr. Lorello's direct appeal of his convictions of first-degree murder and use of a deadly weapon firearm to commit a felony. Mr. Lorello assigns 3 errors, that the evidence supplied by the state for both counts is not sufficient to convict him. The trial court abuses discretion by admitting Exhibit 364, a surveillance footage compilation for the jury's consideration, that he received ineffective assistance of counsel. Before, I promise I'll get to the exhibit argument, because I think that was probably one of the main concerns of the court. But if I could just provide a little bit of the sufficiency argument first, because I think it gives some context to that surveillance footage. In support of the first-degree murder charge, the state produced at trial a significant amount of direct and circumstantial evidence capable of satisfying the fundamental elements of the offenses. It was not just the surveillance compilation footage and not just a couple of points of DNA. The evidence and testimony included that the victim and Mr. Lorello had communicated several times in the day leading up to the murder. The victim was reported missing after meeting with him. No contact or sightings after the meeting at 19350 West Street, which was the residence where the victim's body was found. Navigation data from Mr. Lorello's vehicle showed his route and timing in the night, placing him at the murder scene. Surveillance footage of the Ring doorbell systems around the house show Mr. Sodoro arrive by himself, Mr. Lorello arrive by himself. The two walk separately from their vehicles. Mr. Lorello does not go up to Mr. Sodoro's truck. It remains parked on the street away from the house. They both walk into the house.
Did anyone identify Mr. Lorello as the person walking toward the house?
The circumstantial evidence strongly suggests...
But no witness identified.
No witness, see them going into the house together necessarily. There is a neighbor who arrives who was the former owner of the house, who had been cleaning out the house just prior to the murder, who had sold it to Mr. Sodoro's son, who reported his father missing, who arrives around the time that shortly after both of them go into the house, and Mr. Lorello comes to the door when the neighbor rings the doorbell.
Does the neighbor identify him as Ross Lorello?
I can't remember if it is I believe he does. I think he does.
Knows him?
Doesn't know him, but, you know, in court says, I saw, you know, defendant at, you know, counsel's table. I believe there's a positive identification that was the person that he saw. And Mr. Lorello doesn't deny that he was on the scene. He says, yes, I was there. I met with him. We were exchanging rental paperwork, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But then all of a sudden, Mr. Sodoro leaves the house, gets in a car with somebody else and takes off and goes to another location. And then I get my car and I go on my merry way. Again, the surveillance footage, the Ring doorbell footage and all the surveillance footage in the neighborhood shows all of this. It shows the vehicle that Mr. Lorello is known to be driving. It shows Mr. Sodoro's vehicle that he's known to be driving. It shows them both going to the house. It only shows Mr. Lorello leaving. It does not show another car arriving. I should also note that the surveillance footage, the Ring doorbell footage that's almost directly across the street from this house, goes all the way until you see sheriff's officers arrive several hours later in the dawn hours. So you never see another person walk out of the house besides the person purported to be Mr. Lorello. You never see another vehicle arrive that Mr. Lorello claims that Mr. Sodoro gets in and then drives off with. Instead, what you see is the person alleged to be Mr. Lorello coming out of the house, walking over to Mr. Sodoro's truck, and then driving it away. And through the miracles of modern technology, all the Ring doorbell footage, surveillance systems in the neighborhood consistently show these vehicles coming and going in and out of the neighborhood, including this person drive Mr. Sodoro's truck a couple of blocks away, park it get out, start walking back down the street, and it shows him, you know, walking in front of houses all the way back to the house where the victim's body is found. That person then goes back into the house, comes out, gets into a car matching Mr. Lorello's description, and gets in and drives off and drives away. And all of these things match the navigation data coming from Mr. Lorello's car. It also matches the surveillance footage from the gas stations taken later that was part of this compilation tape. There's DNA evidence showing that Mr. Lorello was at some point on the inside of Mr. Sotero's vehicle. There's also DNA evidence retrieved from a sweatshirt that was left inside of the house, found by sheriff's officers with the victim's body, that had both Mr. Lorello's DNA on it. That same sweatshirt was known by his, I think his girlfriend or his wife and her father, as something that he was wearing that night, found in the house with Mr. Lorello's DNA on it. It's also found with the victim's blood on it. There is the victim's blood, or not blood, it's sorry. The victim's DNA is on the underside of Mr. Lorello's shoe that is found in his house a couple of days later when they come pull up on him.
Both in your brief and here, you've said the victim's DNA. That's not how we talk about DNA evidence, is it? Isn't DNA evidence expressed in terms of probabilities and likelihood?
Right. So DNA, sorry, yes, and I should be more specific here. I should be more specific in my brief. DNA, that the DNA analysts are able to largely, with a high degree of probability, relate back to Mr. Lorello and the victim.
So that's what the testimony is here. It's expressed in terms of probabilities.
Right, and yes, and that testimony shows that there is a high probability that DNA, you know, to be even more precise, I think, cannot exclude them as people that are there.
About like one in quintillions, isn't it, or even higher at this point?
Right, yeah, and I've sat through presentations saying that even that is not a fair representation of what the actual numbers are trying to say. But yes, it's a fairly remote chance that it could be someone else. So combined, and again, in the state's case does not hang solely on the DNA evidence or just the surveillance footage. I mean, there's a ton of evidence available here. You also have the ballistics evidence. The victim's body was found with Ross 4 o'clock written in blue ink on his arm. There was just a lot of things. And again, Mr. Lorello doesn't say, I wasn't there. He just presents a different side of the story, saying there was some sort of dispute, I left. Because Mr. Sotero was getting into it with these other people who had arrived, that I think the argument was is that they were in competition to get this house as well, to rent it from Mr. Sotero, and he got in the car and drove off with them, and so I just packed up my stuff and left. But that doesn't comport, again, with any of the surveillance footage or anything else that is available to the jury in this case. So covering the sufficiency angle and sort of providing that context, I'll turn to the exhibit if there's no further questions on any of that sort of preamble. Mr. Lorello assigned that the district court erred by admitting Exhibit 364, the compilation surveillance videos depicting him or the person alleged to be him walking, and including some slowed versions of already submitted surveillance footage, claiming it to be irrelevant under 401 and unduly prejudicial under 403. Those objections were made prior to trial, and the district court allowed it. This court has permitted the use of techniques that allowed a jury to make a more critical examination of an exhibit already submitted into evidence, that is State versus Hairston, 2017 case. In that case, the jurors used a computer program to reverse the image of a video submitted into evidence, and this court said that was not demonstrative of error requiring a new trial, and specifically said as long as those techniques did not manipulate the video in a manner that altered or augmented what was already contained in the exhibit, in the video source, it did not introduce new information to the jury.
This situation is a little different. We don't have the jurors on their own slowing down or speeding up video. We have it presented as exhibits. Does that make a difference?
I mean, factually, I think it makes a difference. I believe in the Hairston case, the jurors were left with a computer in the deliberation room and started playing with the sliders and all the stuff on the playback information, and that was discovered later on, and that's where the argument stemmed from. This is, you know, as you're noting, purely the state presenting a compilation of videos, one, a couple of which are slowed.
Is that better or worse than having the jury manipulate?
It's different. It's different.
Better for you or worse for you?
probably worse for me, slightly. But I think that ultimately the legal standards that are at play in Hairston inform a decision that ends up in sort of the same place. I think that there's something inherently different about the state engaging in trying to enhance the senses of the jury rather than the jury sort of stumbling into it on their own.
What's the reason for the state presenting the slowed down video next to the real-time video? What's the fact that the state is trying to prove through that?
Well, I believe at the trial, the argument that they make, and they go against the gate analysis. The gate analysis sort of terminology and language is very much on display during the hearings, and the state, you know, is doing a lot of hand-waving, saying, no, we're definitely not engaging in gate analysis. We're not bringing in expert witnesses to talk about, you know, trying to match these things up. We are trying to take the evidence that is in front of us and allowing the jury to have a more direct interaction with these exhibits so that they can make a determination as to identification.
So they can analyze the gate?
Yeah, essentially, yes. I mean, they can, not necessarily just gate, I guess. I mean, you know, it's, I would say overall mannerisms, the, you know, the clothes that the person is wearing, you know, I think identification goes a lot more to just what the, because in some of these videos, I mean, you're looking at somebody that's, you know, fairly close to the camera, so you can see, you know, sort of some of the clothes they're wearing.
So back to my question, what's the slowing down intended to show?
I think it's trying to allow the jurors to engage with the video on a more consumable, you know, sort of timeline. Because some of these videos,
but your opposing counsel said that only some of the videos were slowed down and some of them were presented in real time. What's by only slowing down some? What is the state trying to show?
Well, I think that what they're trying to do is so if I remember correctly, the videos that were slowed down are a lot more brief, or the one that they're trying to show that they compare up to the one that was taken of Mr. Lorella that's confirmed to be him in the gas station. The other one is a shot of a person walking past a house on a Ring doorbell down a sidewalk, and it's very quick. I mean, just a couple of seconds, and I think that what they're trying to show is sort of this person in profile compared to the profile in the surveillance video from the gas station, and trying to slow that down a little bit so that you can make a more full identification of the person, a fuller comparison of those two images rather than just those brief couple of seconds.
In this case is actually, in one sense, better for a defendant than the previous case that we talked about, where the jury was manipulating things using a program. At least here, it's being done openly. If the witnesses are disclosing it, there's the opportunity to object, to cross-examine, to point out any issues. And that's why I was really, I questioned your opponent about whether there was an actual change, or it simply is to compare to the old analog world, slowing down the frames per second of the film going by. The film is still exactly the same, but it's just being looked at a slower rate of change. And in this digital world, I think he conceded that's the situation here. Do you agree?
Yes, I would agree. I don't mean to be too ridiculous. I remember several years ago they had those lawsuits about touchscreen phones, and it was like, well, a tap is just like a really short swipe or something like that. But I mean, I can think of multiple cases, some that I've had very recently, where you've had security stills taken from a store that somebody walks into or something like that. Well, that's a video that you have effectively slowed down to one frame, to an instant in time. And I think that you know, doing so, especially in this instance where you have a sheriff's technician coming on board saying, you know, this is where I got the video from, this is where it was pulled from, this is what I did, and allowing that to be teased out, all the details of that, so that the jury can hear, well, all this is that same video that we just saw, you know, a couple of minutes ago, an exhibit, you know, I can't remember which one it was, but, you know, call it Exhibit 363. Well, now we have Exhibit 364, which is a compilation of a bunch of the videos. You know, you have not only the discovery to juxtapose it to the example of the jury finding it in the jury room, instead of just sort of stumbling upon it, you have the state has to make an offer to the court. They have to explain, you know, they have to lay foundation for it. They're open to an objection. They're open to cross-examination on that. I think that that does make quite a bit of difference. It makes it a little more...
I have a quick question about the records.
Yes, sir.
Were these the slowed videos, were they offered at regular speed at any point in time? Or were they only offered in the slow version?
I'm almost certain they were all offered individually as their own individual exhibits in regular time.
And then there were the subsequent exhibits that were offered with the action being slowed.
Yes. And it is, and I should also make the point, and I can't remember if this is fully investigated at trial or fully teased out at trial, but when they say slowed, the technician who is pulling the exhibit and who is there to lay the foundation for it and describe what's going on there, it's not, to use another sort of modern, it's not auto-tune. They're not trying to match the footprint for foot, you know, beat for beat so that the gates are lined up. She says at trial, all I did was cut the video by half.
But there was no offer of screenshots from the ring and screenshot from the convenience store to compare for purposes of identification.
Right, no, that did not happen. I mean, alternatively, though, I guess, and maybe this is me just sort of wondering aloud, is it any different from watching the video and hitting pause right in the middle of, you know, an extension of the leg or a gait or something like that? And I would contend that it's not. It's simply just playing the video that's there at a different speed so that you can use it as a tool that operates as an extension of the jury's sense of sight and ability to perceive and take in that exhibit. Among others that are offered. Again, there were multiple surveillance videos offered. I mean, a lot.
So the state's position is ultimately it comes down to 403 abuse of discretion.
And yes.
The state says no abuse.
Yes, that is my position in the brief. And then as far as unduly prejudicial, given all the other evidence and given all the other surveillance footage too, I mean, I just don't see this being something that gets close to 403. And, you know, getting into the 401 argument too, as far as relevancy, when we don't have a direct, you know, to address Mr. Lareau's argument head on, yeah, we don't have a video of who shot Mr. Sotero directly. We don't have that. We don't have all of that direct evidence, all that wonderful direct evidence in front of us, so we have to, you know, go on the case that we've got in front of us.
Seems to me it's more of a 901 authentication question than it is a 401 relevance objection.
That's an argument certainly you could raise. I mean, I don't think that you have as much of an authentication problem given the technician that came up and who described how that, where that information, you have the investigators that talked about how they got it, and they went, they testified, you know, we canvassed the neighborhood, went to the neighbors, and they said, oh, yes, I've got a Ring doorbell. I'd be happy to pull that information up for you, and handing it over to them, where the technicians then sit and watch every minute and every second of it until they come up with the verifiable stuff. But, I mean, certainly that is an argument you could raise, but aside from slowing the video down and getting the video from the neighbors, I mean, there's not a lot of processing that goes on here, or a lot of sort of curating or enhancement, aside from what you can do with a VLC player on your computer. If there are no further questions on that, I would just move on to the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and I would submit on the rest of my sufficiency argument, having sort of blown through the first part of that, unless there are additional questions related. Mr. Lareau claims that his trial counsel was deficient for not investigating incidents he alleges to have witnessed of inappropriate contact between jurors, the state, and the victim's family. The record may be insufficient to address these claims. However, the state argues alternatively that Mr. Lareau has not provided possibly the requisite specificity in particular.
What more did he need to say?
I'm not exactly sure what you could really say at that point. Maybe at what point those conversations happened? Did that happen?
How would that help us?
Well, I think that perhaps the closer to a certain tipping point in the trial, you know, maybe at the close of a, you know, the state's case, or, you know, at the submission of the jury, or I'm not sure if it's explicitly identified when this sort of contact happens.
it might make someone investigating it or trying to investigate it know who the witnesses might be or...
Yeah, and that would certainly help too.
At a certain point in time.
There's just sort of the allegation that jurors and the state start talking, I believe, and then...
It's fair, your opponent's argument that there's no way for his client to know what was actually said. That's a fair argument, correct?
Isn't there a way that his client might have been able to identify which juror it was or which member of the county attorney's office it was or on which day it happened?
Both fair points, both unfortunately for me and fortunately for me, I think. I think it is not my strongest argument. I think that, you know, certainly a further hearing on the matter to find out whether or not Mr. Lorillo even asked his attorney about this or said something about it could be, you know, or, you know, whoever the prosecutor was could be fairly definitive. You know, those people could say, yeah, like, those people weren't jurors. Those people weren't family members, actually. That was...
So what we're discussing, is this adequate at this stage?
I'm not 100% sure. I don't think that... I think that, obviously, I'm making the argument in the alternative, but I think given what we've got before us, I'm not sure if there's a whole lot to go on to figure out whether or not there's any real juice to this claim. But there's certainly, if it is enough, it's probably the bare minimum, maybe, to identify, you know, a group of people that were, you know, having conversations in there for. I mean, I will say, and if I can really quick, and I'll finish this up, I promise.
Really quick, go for it.
Thank you. We also have, you know, several warnings from the district court, you know, not to talk about the case with anybody else. Doesn't say, you know, don't talk to anybody. Just says, don't talk to this case about this case to anybody else. And there's several warnings to the jury and to everybody else there. So, you know, you also have that aspect of it, which could help cure any sort of, you know, problem here. You know, provide some sort of forewarning or something like that. So, but if there are no further questions, thank you for letting me go over my time.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
We don't have any time for rebuttal. Mr. Hugg, thank you very much for your service. And counsel, you are both excused. And the next case of the day, then, is Bowling versus Tecumseh Poultry, LLC. Justice Miller-Lerman is recused from this matter, and she has just exited the court, and I think we're going to have a new judge enter, and we do have a new judge, and I'm going to let this judge introduce